Welcome to the MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffin.com, to keep up on our previous episodes. We most recently talked about the Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Before that was On the Waterfront. Before that was The Candidate. And before that was an equally famous film called Gentlemen Broncos. So, themacguffin.com, and you can check those out whenever. All right, James.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are, talking about the man who would be king.
That's right.
Yeah.
Remember Treasure of Sierra Madre?
I do. It was a little over a month ago, maybe slightly less than a month. Time is a flat circle. Who can remember?
Yeah. So was it just a John Huston marathon in your life that made you want to do this one?
No, I had never seen The Man Who Would Be King, and... whenever we were in the beginning stages of doing that Treasure of the Sierra Madre podcast, I initially was going to suggest The Man Who Would Be King. I think I did initially suggest it. And then I watched The Man Who Would Be King and felt like I would bring up the Treasure of the Sierra Madre a lot. And so figured we should just do them in order and that it would make more sense. It didn't necessarily mean they would have to be back to back, but that's just sort of how the metaphorical cookie crumbled.
Yeah, and there's still, I see the connection why you'd want to talk about one with the other. It's still very different movies, and obviously we should just say both directed by John Huston, which would be the thread connecting those two things. Mm-hmm. Different times of his career, different kind of feel, but still, you know, a lot of connective tissue, right?
Yes, for sure. And, like, stylistically, they're not similar. The tone of the movies is not similar, I don't think. Like... but they clearly sort of, I think it's mostly just the desire for power and success in, within the world. I think that really ties these together. And the tone is so different too, you know, like The Man Who Would Be King is just, it's a rollicking sort of good time, you know, whereas The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, while a very entertaining sort of adventure film, is much more, a much more static film. Like, there's a lot of traveling going on, but characters get to a place and then stay there for a while. But this one, there's almost constant movement for the first hour of the movie, pretty much. And just in general, the way Sean Connery and Michael Caine, the two stars of this movie, are playing their roles is just... I guess they're both like Walter Huston in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, right down to almost looking directly in the camera and winking.
Yeah, and just in reading reviews for this movie that came out, you know, shortly after its release, and this movie was received very well, but the one thing that you get in a lot of them is how much people just enjoyed that it was fun. And this story on paper, you know, if you talk about the amount of traveling, people ascending to the throne and, mm-hmm. you know, becoming gods, mm-hmm. or at least thought of that way. it just sounds like it's going to be a 3-hour epic movie that is entirely humorless.
Yeah.
And that's not what this movie is. And that's the thing, that, I mean, one of the many things people did like about it, or at least talked about in the reviews of it, is that it was fun. And these two people starring in this movie clearly like each other and like working with each other. And we'll talk more qualitative about, you know, their performances maybe, but it just seemed like a lot more fun than you might think a movie like this was going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you can, what you were describing, you can very easily see the David Lean version of this movie, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm no Lean scholar, but this is not, when I think of like Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge on the River Kwai or whatever Lean movie you want to point to, Brief Encounter, Dr. Zhivago, they don't have that feel that I find in The Man Who Would Be King. And I don't know, there's just more fun. And I do think a lot of that does lead back to the casting, just in that John Huston famously didn't really tell actors what to do. He sort of figured that his job was to cast them, their job was to act and be entertaining. And I think just the pairing of Connery and Michael Caine, who both seem to like having fun. They both, I don't know. There seems to be an air of jovialness to each of them. And they clearly get along. I I reject the idea that they were following the script word for word, just because of some of the things Sean Connery says in this movie have to absolutely be Sean Connery changing his own lines. Like when he says bloody high and bleeding likely or something, bloody high and bleeding mighty or whatever towards the end of the movie, I'm like, okay, that was not in the script. There's no way. And just all of those things. And I think just John Huston in general was willing to sit back and let the actors act. And I don't know, I think he felt it was his job to build a world for them to exist in. But once the world was built, he kind of just had to let them do what they wanted. And it just so happened that Kane and Connery fit together perfectly. You know, so the world building was a success.
Yeah, and I was reading more about his style that, you know, compared to like all the movies he's made as well. People just saying that he's a very kind of straightforward filmmaker and kind of knows what he wants. And I think it was Kane said some directors use a camera like a machine gun, and Huston uses his like a sniper rifle. Like he just he doesn't film a lot. He said like, I don't even really know who the editors on some of my movies were, because it's just that wasn't a big part of the process. He kind of had all this. Mm-hmm. All these ideas in his mind about what this movie was going to look like, and that he was a painter when he was young, and he would sketch out so many shots and you know, the camera setups and lighting and blocking, and that just wasn't something that was done as much. Like we always know storyboarding is still done to this day and obviously done then, but it sounds like he did his to a degree that other people weren't doing it.
Yeah, and I think part of the, because I remember that story about him not knowing editors, I think that may be first came up when we did the Maltese Falcon, but I think part of that might have been just sort of the studio system early in his career, and that maybe a lot of it, directors didn't know their editors because they finished shooting and just immediately started shooting something else. But yeah, I know what you mean, and John Huston just in general has, just listening to him talk about filmmaking a lot of the time, it's him basically saying, well, everybody else does this, but I think it's stupid. This is what I do, you know? And that sniper rifle comment really plays into to what you're discussing there.
Yeah. I mean, do you see he has a very good eye? Like, are all those things about how much things are set up and just kind of the more the composition of the frame, does that show up to you a lot in this?
I am going to say, I'm going to say no. Like, I think this is a very well-made movie. And we talked a little bit about this on the Treasure of the Sierra Madre and maybe Maltese Falcon years ago, but it's, I like John Huston as a filmmaker, but I don't think he cares about the image as much as as much as most of my favorite directors do. This is a very beautiful movie and just 1970s, big budget Hollywood movie shot on anamorphic lenses is just
on like not on location, but you know, not.
not on a studio set. Yeah, there's just there are so many things about the style of this movie that are exactly what I want in filmmaking, you know. And but it's just the I mean a movie maybe 3-4 years later, 5 years later, I guess, is Raiders of the Lost Ark that does all of these same things, but there's just Spielberg is a formless master, and just the way he moves the camera in Raiders of the Lost Ark is about as good as anybody has ever done it. Like, that's the thing that is a lot of the times missing from Huston to me, but I in no way mean that as a negative. I just mean that is Huston's style, you know? And when I think of him, in my head, we've made this comparison before, he feels like a writer who directs as opposed to a director who writes. And and I think that's a good way of summing it up. You know, most of my favorite directors are directors who sometimes write or don't write at all. But I think Huston, I mean, he was a writer first. He made his living as a writer in Hollywood before he ever directed anything. And I think that's the thing in John Huston that... I don't want to say I can never love him, but can't, I don't know, won't be like drunkenly yelling at people at a party for trashing this movie, you know?
Yeah, let's hope that doesn't come up.
Imagine being at a party in 2019 where I am just screaming at somebody over The Man Who Would Be King. Like, what is the scenario where that has to happen for this conversation to start that's not you, you know? Like... like, who have I found? Anyway, I think I should probably just befriend that person instead of screaming at them.
Instead of drunkenly yelling at them?
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems right.
But we'll cross that rope bridge when we come to it.
Good, very nice. And I mean, you bring up Lost Ark, and Spielberg has talked about how this was an inspiration for that. You can see that they, again, are different movies, but once again, you can kind of see it's not too hard to connect the dots between them.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's a rope bridge scene in the Temple of Doom that's pretty clearly inspired by Man Who Would Be King. I don't think I've seen the Temple of Doom since I was a kid, but I vaguely remember it.
Yeah. Oh, it was funny talking about Houston as a writer, too, and that later in his career he chose to act more. And that's, I don't know, I found that unusual, too.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I love reading him talking about acting. He doesn't think he was a particularly good actor. I think he liked his performance in Chinatown, and pretty much the rest of it he just did because it was easier than directing, and they paid well. And he was always very vocal about how easy it was, too.
Yeah, it didn't seem like he poured his heart and soul into it and just didn't think of himself as the best. I just didn't think, like, he didn't seem to think that was a pursuit for him, but he could just do it well enough to get by and, yeah, to cash a check.
Yeah, I mean, he has that, like, self-confidence that just makes you good on camera. Like, everything I read about John Huston is just, he is such an old school, I am who I am and I don't really give a shit what you think about it sort of guy. And that seems to be the type of person who does not flinch when a camera is pointed at them. And it makes perfect sense. And I mean, I think the only movie I've seen him act in is Chinatown, and he is fantastic in Chinatown.
Yeah.
You know, he just happened, he has there's a presence about him, you know. I mean, I think I saw him act in Chinatown before I saw anything he had directed. So.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny, like, just thinking of him as this guy who kind of knows what he is and doing what he wants to do, because reading about his entire filmography and the trends that are, you know, you find throughout a lot of his movies, that there's this idea of people just trying something, you know, having a quest, or even especially in this one, choose, like, this is such a choice to do what they set out to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he talks about, oh, the war's over, you really expect us to go back home for, you know, to work as a porter or something. You know, it does kind of seem like there is some circumstance that put them here, but they go on a massive journey to a different country. Like, yes. this didn't fall into their lap, right?
Yeah, no, exactly.
But that so many of the movies are about these people who go on these quests and often fail. And mm-hmm. I think that's a very interesting thing for someone who, I don't know if he would describe himself as an optimist, but he was not super political, but he was saying making movies that about something. It's just interesting to see how often it goes poorly for these people. And this is such a perfect example of it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And yes, I agree. And I think he just sort of, I don't know, I think he has this view that it's so hard for everything to work out perfectly. And the three Houston movies we have done that don't work out perfectly for everybody, it's the things that are trying to be accomplished in those movies are, you know, you're really reaching for the top, you know, especially this one. You're trying to be the king of a civilization, you know, and just
it convince people you're a god eventually.
Exactly.
Like, that's where it ends up, at least.
So I think the worldview is more that the higher you reach, the harder it is going to be for these things to work out. And I think these movies are people that are just sort of reaching higher than the average person. And I think maybe John Huston views that it's easy to have, much easier to have sort of a successful normal life. But these people just happen to be reaching higher than maybe anybody should be reaching. And that's definitely the viewpoint of this movie. You know, the fact that they make it as far as they do is just an absolute miracle. You know, if only surviving it after that, were down to their last fire and being saved by an avalanche that fills a crevasse, like that alone is an absolute miracle, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty early on in this movie that they're like, oh, don't worry, I'll kill you when this
absolutely
existence becomes insufferable.
Yeah, I mean, which in that situation, especially for military men, like that makes more sense than them just slowly freezing to death, you know. You know what I mean?
No, it does, but I just also think the way it speaks to this movie as, you know, something that is so epic and serious kind of lighthearted as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I have a question for you before we get too deep into it, because I have no answer for this question, and if you have a strong answer, maybe it changes how I feel about the movie. What's the deal with the Masons in this movie? because I don't know if there's something I'm missing about it, but that is the one thing that I spent a lot of time thinking about and couldn't really come to a strong conclusion about.
Yeah, no, I don't know that it's that there's much to it. I think it's a very convenient plot device.
Yeah.
And you know that it's kind of just the idea of that this would work and that that they had that knowledge all the way back then to like in that part of the world that someone being a contemporary Mason could be as important as it ends up being for that character.
Okay.
But no, I thought about it as well. I just don't know that there is anything more to it than that.
Yeah, and it just seems amazing that the three characters we're introduced to all happen to be Masons. I mean, it makes sense that Danny and Peachy both are, but that the one other, I don't know, it just seems extremely convenient, Kipling happens to be. But yeah, and I think the one thing I liked about it was maybe the early on when Kipling is trying to convince his boss at the Northern Star to let Peachy and Danny be the correspondents or whatever he's trying to convince them of, and before Peachy and Danny make their entrance and yell about hats on, hats off. his boss is saying, Kipling's mentioning that they're Masons or whatever, and his boss is saying that's something from English society we probably should have left behind. I thought that was despite being a small comment, I think that maybe speaks to the idea that maybe having these small, not necessarily secret brotherhoods, but definitely slightly hidden types of brotherhoods, which is kind of what they're building in their eventual wannabe kingdom as well. They're just sort of negative and maybe they shouldn't exist, but that's as far as I got with it, you know?
No, I think that's true. And I think that just the idea of having powerful people and governments run on, and I'm not saying this is a like Freemason conspiracy theorist, but just the idea of any bodies set up, you know, by not just whoever has the best idea should be the one who gets to make choices. And I think that that comment about something that should be left behind, I think just speaks to that. Just if the English think of themselves as these very forward people who, you know, are just in the colonial era, making life better for other people, to keep an idea like that going while you're imposing your will on all these other countries seems like such an obviously bad idea.
Yeah, and I think one of my favorite things about the movie is that Peachy and Danny leave society because they feel like they can't live the life that they want within the rules of established society. And they're both military men. They've built their lives on being told what to do. And now they're just sort of, eventually they've just become fed up. They're not like outwardly blaming society for their own failures necessarily, but they definitely don't feel like they fit or they can have the level of success that they want within the established rules of their society, so they have to build their own, you know. And there's especially in, I think it's the train car, where there's a lot of talk, Peachy's talking a lot about how he hates bureaucrats, there's a line in there somewhere where he or Danny says, government spends all their time making up new laws to stop men like you and me from getting anywhere. And I think just their rejection of any sort of established society except for the society that they have established, I think speaks to the level of, I guess for lack of a better word, chutzpah they both have, you know, like the absolute stone cold belief in what they think and that what they think is right, but not necessarily realizing that what they think is right for them is right for everybody, you know? And I think that's something that's so important and runs throughout the movie. And all of those aspects play throughout. They hate bureaucrats, so they try and become their own rulers, you know?
Yeah, and even that is kind of this dark, heavy notion, you know, that this society, like, they're not, you know, it's not as though they just don't seem so angry at everybody. You know, it's not these veterans who are so upset with the world. It's played off as this like mid-50s millionaire playboy thing in the 1880s, it does take this very odd and light form. But I think, yeah, all of that is absolutely correct.
Yeah, and at this time, also, India is under the rule of the United Kingdom, you know? So they are, they have been soldiers in taking over a society already, you know? So.
Yeah, and just because of, you know, having seen and talked about Treasure of Sierra Madre so recently, and you know, the obvious connections we've talked about, the kind of thirst for wealth or power that runs through this, and Treasure of Sierra Madre, it's so much drier and darker and more straightforward. Do you think it takes any of the edge off the, you know, capital L lesson of this, but the way that it is, you know, done with more levity?
I think if I'm putting one of these two movies in a time capsule, it's 100% The Treasures of Sierra Madre. Like, and it is not close. There's something about just the care of that movie, and I just think it's a better movie. I think The Man Who Would Be King is a very good movie that's absolutely elevated by two lead performances that are so goddamn charismatic that it sort of it takes it over a level higher than it could have been. So yeah, I see what you're saying, but I think there are, and I also don't want to say that I'm picking movies on top of the idea that, or based on the idea that the lesson is learned better in one than the other, you know, because I don't really feel like that's what I'm going to movies for. But I think the thought process is more thorough in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and I think you can just look at my notes for this movie and my notes for The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. I think I had 5 pages for Sierra Madre and 3 for this, you know? So I think there's a two pages of a gap between the two movies. And there's just something about the care put into the older movie that I just appreciate. But I definitely think for a piece of entertainment that really is, I bet this was either a summer or holiday sort of blockbuster at the time. You know, it was probably released in a time when the studio was expecting a lot of people to go to movies and a lot of people to want to see an adventure. And I don't know if I could say the same about The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, but I don't know. I feel like this movie maybe had goals that weren't as lofty anyway, and was trying to lean towards entertainment, and I think it absolutely succeeds in that.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think that there is, you know, a moral to this, and I think that you can see some of John Huston's politics and personality throughout this, but it doesn't seem as concerned with moralizing. And again, that's just, it's because of the scale that it's on, it seems like it very easily could have been that, but that's just not what this movie seems like it's set out to do. You know, you see that greed is bad and wanting to become a god maybe isn't the most helpful. You know, like it's just not as not that Treasure of Sierra Madre was saying, you know, something entirely new and profound, but just doing it in a way that you know, like There'll Be Blood is still very entertaining, but seems like it really wants you to think about these things, you know, with some gravity, the way that Treasure of Sierra Madre did. And this just doesn't seem as much. That's not the priority for this movie. And yeah, I think it's more entertaining, more accessible in as a result of that.
Yeah, and I think maybe the difference is, I don't, and we talked about The Treasure of Sierra Madre a lot to try and get to a conclusion, and I don't think the movie gives a strong conclusion about what it wants you to think, whereas I feel like The Man Who Would Be King does. I think the lesson of The Man Who Would Be King is to get the crown, you have to lose your head. And I think the last shot illustrates that rather obviously. And I feel like maybe that's the difference, is that there's more telling me what to think in The Man Who Would Be King. And I mean that marginally, but still. The Treasure of the Sierra Madre is more, the meaning sort of gets carried away with the wind, as opposed to ending on a close-up of something that's pretty clearly a symbol of the whole story that we've seen. And I don't think it's corny in any way. It's not like it's not like a character telling you exactly what to think. You know, it's still at least a visual visual guidepost that you have to sort out for yourself. But I do think that's a big difference between these movies and my level of passion towards them, you know?
Yeah, and there's a couple of big visual metaphors, and one that I actually like that wasn't so big is when Peachy's telling him that he's going to leave and he's not gonna, you know, it's before he says he's gonna stick around for the wedding.
Yes, I love this. I know exactly what you're talking about.
what part? Like, what is it about?
It's
that
the the sort of divider between them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even know what to call it because it's not drapes. it's like
not things, like those hippie beads.
Yeah, but... no, exactly. That's the other thing I was going to say. It's just some sort of divider that you can see through. Like you can tell that it's Sean Connery on the other side or Michael Caine on the other side. But it's just an obscuring of your vision, you know?
Yeah. And he moves them to the side. Danny moves them to the side when he asks Peachy to stay for the wedding. Like, mm-hmm. He's putting in a bit of effort to kind of bring back that connection that they had. And they've just been growing apart through this movie. And there's just, you know, one of them is playing a ruler and one of them is playing a god. You know, there's just such a divide in how he does it. And even the part where when he's asked to bow in front of him just for appearances, right?
Oh, yeah, you know, for sure.
Pretend that I'm a god, we kind of have to go with this. And I thought that was going to be the beginning of them unraveling, that it's gone to his head. And we don't, I mean, that is true to a sense, but we don't really see that happen for a while where they have that argument of, you know, you're clearly starting to think too much of yourself and you're not just playing this part to fool people anymore. Like, you really do think you're the son of Alexander? That's a different step. Like, that, yeah. Something has happened in your brain. And I really just enjoyed the touch of when he says, when the queen gives you the order, when Peachy says that to Danny, he reaches around the beads, and that there is still something so fundamental about their mutual Englishness that, you know, that comes up so often in this movie, that even with everything that's changed and the growing animosity between them, they still have that shared nationalism and that shared history that they're still relating to, and that allows them to still function.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what you're talking about is another thing I love about this movie is just the and again, Caine and Connery clearly liking each other is so important to the movie for this reason, is that it's a really good illustration of friendship and what can happen to a friendship when you undertake something like this. I mean, I guess I have to trust the filmmakers and Rudyard Kipling, but that is what you're describing with the whatever beads or whatever that we can't quite see through but can see through, is that these are two guys that go far back. So far back, we don't really know when their friendship really starts. Maybe at a Masons meeting or something, maybe in the military. But that they've been through so much that slowly they have sort of started to not be able to see each other as clearly as they could at the beginning of the movie. At the beginning of the movie, they know each other as well as you can know another friend. Just because they've been through these very specific experiences together. They laugh about a bunch of them while they're waiting for the miracle avalanche to happen. And all of the trouble comes basically once they start trying to build their kingdom. And what you're saying with the asking Peachy to bow in front of him, before that, Danny says something like, things would be easier if the people thought he was a god, you know. Those things are, they're not, you know, they're not big blow up moments. It's not Danny asking Peachy to bow and then Peachy being like, well, no, we're arguing about this now. It's like, yeah, I agree, this is logical, but that would still, yeah, that would still have an effect on a friendship, you know. Yeah. I mean, I have never asked you to bow to me like a god, but I would imagine that would affect our relationship going forward. And there are more examples when Danny decides the contract has lapsed before he is to be wed, and when he begins to wonder if maybe he's a god. You know, like, Peachy stays more the same than Danny does, for sure. Danny goes through a more transformative experience almost entirely internally. And that's what that separation between them is. They still know each other. They still can see each other. They still have that past together. But now they have a hard time seeing each other perfectly clearly. And it's notable that, as you said, when Danny does reach out to pull the beads back a little bit, it's to ask him to stay for his wedding, which is just a very something that's absolutely rooted in friendship, you know?
Yeah. So. And it ties back to what you kind of opened with, this idea that they were not, like, they couldn't possibly function in the military anymore. And for all the unhappiness I'm sure they experienced, that when they were being told what to do, it didn't really matter what they thought. They were just there for each other as friends. But now that they have all this agency in their life and they get to make these own big choices, the difference between you is obviously magnified by a million, because, you know, if you're just doing the same thing because you're just following the same orders, your personality, you know, you believe that they're friends because they have similar personalities, but just this being able to do these things and being able to, as I said, like, have your own agency and actualize what it is that's in your brain on the real world, because you're not just following orders. Now you're the ones making it. The divide in your personality becomes so much bigger and leads to this, you know, inevitable blow up.
Yeah, for sure. And I do want to point out one thing very early on in the movie. That's one of my favorite parts of the movie, and I think it really speaks to what we're talking about their friendship, is when they're drawing up the contract and Peachy's reading it aloud. He says something along the lines of, and if one of us gets into, it's one of the articles of the contract, and one of us gets into trouble, the other will stay by him. And Danny immediately says, there's no need for that last article, but it's got a ring to it, you know? And I think that's such a small line, but it speaks. So I mean, what he's saying is, like, obviously I would stay by my friend. Like, that's the level of friendship we've established with each other. And I think that's a really, really nice, very small moment. And it's rare that you, in a Hollywood movie, see two men talk about each other that way, especially without it being a scene of consequence in any way. It's just sort of like, yeah, that's obviously, you know, like, I don't need to elucidate that any further. This is just something that would happen.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point.
Yeah, and it's a good line and a good scene. And yeah, the dissolution of a friendship, but not entire dissolution of it, I think, is the thing about this movie that I find very interesting. Because a lot of the times when you see a quest movie like this, it's either strangers coming together, like The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, or it's a lonely man trying to do it all on his own. And I think that seeing these two work together in concert for so long and then have them slowly start to fall apart is one of the strongest aspects of this movie.
So what do you think of the other hypothetical pairings with the two lead actors?
Was one of them Paul Newman and Robert Redford?
Yeah.
I don't
know how serious that ever is, obviously, but it seemed like this was a book, you know, the Rudyard Kipling, who we haven't really mentioned, the short story that this movie's based on, was a very important book to Houston when he was younger. And so it was just something that, as he got into making films, it was something he just always wanted to do, was to make this movie. And so it was, you know, he wanted Humphrey Bogart and Clark Gable, and then Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas, and Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole, and then Robert Redford and Paul Newman apparently were asked, and they suggested these two, or one of them suggested these two. But just that idea of, you know, these Hollywood icons being thought of in these roles, just as Houston continues on with his career and gets bigger and bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he was trying to make this movie since the 50s. You know, this movie's released in 1975, and he'd been trying to get it made for 20 years. You know, it's a recent example that's kind of like this, where a legacy director is trying to get something off the ground for multiple decades, is Martin Scorsese's Silence. You know, sometimes for some reason, one of the best directors currently working in the world cannot get a movie made that is near and dear to their heart, and they don't give up on it. And those movies are always very interesting. I feel like I don't know. And I feel like if I was a huge John Huston fan, this would be a movie that would absolutely fascinate me. I just don't, like Silence absolutely fascinated me, because I've seen, I think, all but one of Scorsese's movies. Just because it's a movie that somebody cares so much about, I feel like you really get the real director showing up. And I find it interesting that Something that Houston wanted to do for 20 years is something that is at its heart an adventure film, you know? And I think I find that really interesting because that's also not really the perception I have of him as a person, you know?
Yeah.
I picture him, like, my version of John Huston in my head is more closely aligned with Humphrey Bogart, just because I know that they were friends and that they were drinking buddies, even drinking buddies on sets of movies that they were not working together on, like Casablanca, when they would drink together every night. And that's just a long way of saying I bet Houston scholars are absolutely fascinated by this movie, specifically because it was a dream project for him.
Yeah, you know? It is about two friends, and I haven't read the short story, but I bet it's humorous as well. So, it's not crazy that this ended up being kind of lighter fare. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm with you, because anything that you've thought about for that long that is so close to your heart just seems like it has to be heavier, and it's not.
Yeah, well, and I the example of Silence is an easy one, because that is such a heavy movie, and there are a couple moments in that movie where I'm just like, oh, he clearly thought of that in 1998 and has been sitting on it since. And this one, it feels more natural. But also, John Huston does really feel like the type of guy that him thinking about a movie for 20 years might have been, well, Humphrey Bogart died, I got to regroup. And he would think about it over four whiskeys one night and then not think about it again for a year and a half, you know? Again, this is my perception of John Huston that is not rooted in sort of scholastic pursuits. But I don't know. Martin Scorsese seems like the type of guy that thinks about the same thing every day until it's done, whereas John Huston does not. Partially because he's drunker, you know. Martin Scorsese hasn't done cocaine since the 80s, despite what his films try to tell us.
But I'm sure it helped him focus.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how we got on that tangent. But...
Oh, it's okay. Did you want to talk about any kind of the heavier stuff, the colonialism and maybe some of the more, like, the things in this movie that do try to be serious?
I think that the one thing I do want to mention, one quick line that doesn't really tie into what you're asking, but I just think if I forget to mention it, I will be upset.
Yeah,
it's early on. It's when Peachy's come back and he's Kipling doesn't recognize him, and he's just telling him who he is. He's Peachy. We signed a contract together. And as they're going back into this, as he's starting the story, that becomes the movie proper. He says he's the same but not the same man who sat beside you on the train 3 summers and 100 years ago.
Yeah, I have that same note.
Oh, I love that line. Had it just been one of those two phrases, like the same but not the same man who sat beside you on the train or 3 summers and 100 years ago, it would have been in my notes regardless. But the fact that it's those two things perfectly sandwiched next to each other, I think is just, it's such a beautiful line, you know? And I have to assume that it came from the short story, just because that sounds like something that was written in the 1800s, you know?
As I said, I wrote down the same thing. It is just, I can't really place it into a bigger context of why it's, you know, I see why it makes sense, you know, but it was just like this little tidbit of something. I was like, oh, okay, check mark. Like,
yeah,
gold star right there.
Moving on. Exactly. And especially since we don't know the story yet, but we know who Michael Caine is, and we know that's not what Michael Caine looks like normally. Just the idea that, you have to go through a lot to look how Peachy Carnahan does in that scene. And it's basically like he lived multiple lives to get to where he is, you know, by the standard, the standard of normal human existence. You know, he packs a lot in. Excuse me, to those 3 summers, but I just think that's such a good line and such a good way to start our story.
Yeah, and another one I enjoyed is when he said they're training the villagers. He says, "When we're done with your training, you'll be able to slaughter your enemies like civilized men."
And oh yes, no, that's a great line.
Yeah, and I mean is funny, and I mean quickly gets to a lot of things about this story and stories just like it, of, you know, the real idea of civilizational progress and the ability to kill a lot of people quickly being a good thing and simultaneously the worst thing ever.
Yeah, exactly. But going back to what you were saying about the more serious themes of this movie. I think the one that I focused on and really enjoyed is the idea of the white savior, white savior in film specifically, because this is something I always find very interesting. And just the idea that, I don't know. I mean, this one, it feels a little bit trickier than this isn't Michelle Pfeiffer teaching inner city kids about Bob Dylan being the first rapper, you know. It's not like that type of white savior. That's the type I'm really fascinated with. But
yeah, that's why I was extra curious about what you were gonna think of it, because it's not as straightforward as that, and I mean straightforward in kind of the worst way.
Yeah, no, exactly. Dangerous. You're right. Dangerous Minds is a terrible fucking movie. You're right.
I mean, there's. And you know, a lot of the kind of main things from those tropes are found in here, but it's not quite as down the middle as other things.
No, like exactly, because it's built upon a misperception. Like these people think that Danny is a literal god, and it just happens to be that an arrow got caught in his belt of ammo or whatever it is.
His bandolier, yeah.
Oh, that's another moment of friendship I love, when Peachy's really mad at him for charging into battle, and that conversation that they have. I think that's so cute. It's like why would you do that?
Yeah,
you know, like that's so dangerous. You're not the man you used to be 10 years ago or whatever. That whole conversation is so funny and so great. But anyway, I digress. But just the idea of the white savior narrative and the fact that as soon as they see Danny bleed, nobody believes he is a god. But I don't know. It did sort of just still feel like, watching it now, it felt like a movie about the falseness of the white savior, you know, because that's exactly what it turns out to be. It turns out to be a false god, because he's not a god at all. He's human. And I guess I don't have a lot of thoughts to add to that, but it does, the movie does nicely play into just a trope in movies that I find deeply annoying.
Yeah, and I didn't know a ton about this movie, but you kind of see where it's heading early on.
Yeah, you don't think it's going to end with them ruling over a society happily.
At least not forever, yeah.
Yeah, because we have seen one movie before in our lifetime.
Yeah. And so I just kind of instantly getting curious of, you know, 1880s by way of 1875, and then a cultural, you know, clash of any kind. Mm-hmm. I knew it was going to be pretty loaded with things, but I just didn't know exactly how. And I think it avoids a lot of the big missteps that you do run into, as you said, like it is based on a misperception. And yeah, I think that they play with it nicely without being overly horrendous about some of the things that you quickly run into with those kinds of movies.
Yeah, exactly. And especially, like, I don't think Huston thought about it at all, making this movie as a white savior movie. I don't think he thought, oh, I'm going to make a white savior movie, but then talk about how the white savior's false. I don't think he thought about that at all, especially since most of the movies I think of as white savior movies aren't released until 1990 or afterwards, you know, so this, it might not have been a conversation at the time. And there are, I was actually surprised this movie wasn't more racist.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
That one specifically, I certainly felt bad for women in general watching this movie. Yeah. Women are entirely props, and the wedding sequence, I just felt so bad for that woman, because like the whole time, her mindset is, this is my wedding, but when he touches me, I will burst into flames.
Yeah.
Like, she has to deal with this whole pomp and circumstance of a wedding, and her assumption is she will be, the end of it is her catching fire. And yeah, like, just having to go through that experience, going through the nights before when she knows she's going to be married to him, and she has no agency, no way to say no. This is just what's going to happen. And again, I cannot stress enough, she spends this whole time assuming she is going to burst into flames at the end of it. Like, it's just that poor woman.
It's not just a shotgun wedding that, like, we've seen in other movies.
Yeah, exactly. It's a spontaneous combustion wedding. And again, that's, I mean, any movie from I mean, still to this day, most movies we can talk about as having problems like this. But I know it was partially of the time, and also since this is a story that takes place in the 1800s, you got to double it. But still, yeah. it needs to be mentioned. And I'm sure there's stuff that I've missed mentioning, but you got to mention these things to talk about them historically, just to be like, hey, that was kind of fucked up that we thought about things this way.
Yeah. And I'll say that the fact that after he's revealed to not be a god, that his death comes by them cutting the rope bridge that he had made, and to that connection that was built between the old world and this world. Oh, I guess, yeah. I mean the new world and this world, the English society and Kharifistan society. You know, that's where he meets his demise. Just this, the very physical representation of the connection of these two worlds.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much the only physical representation of the connection of the two worlds, at least that we know about, right? Because
his wife. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, a lot of time passes, but they never really show us anything other than the bridge as being a new addition to this world.
Yeah, right. And then they even show his bride to be coming over that same bridge too, and as you said, being very, very constantly just, you know, beyond upset, just this notion of her imminent death on a day of being the center of attention while everybody else is celebrating.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you going through your graduation ceremony and then, oh, here's your degree, cool, now you're in flames, you know, like it's so like that was something that absolutely, like, I just could not stop thinking about the first time I watched this movie, in that scene, like the mindset of that person, it would just have to be so terrifying.
But yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing she can walk. You know,
yeah,
just out of sheer terror. Wrong. But I don't know, I don't feel like I have anything else to say about the movie, if you don't.
No, I think I'm good.
Okay, great. Well, now that we've talked,
God's Holy Trousers.
Sorry,
God's Holy Trousers.
Oh, there's so many little little things in this movie. I think oh yeah, I've got this note. Sean Connery says, "Peachy, it would be stone bonkers to walk into a city by our lones." Stone bonkers is so fantastic. And I want to know if that was a Conneryism or if that's in the script, but regardless, it is now in my lexicon. But yeah, thank you for listening to McGuffman, and check back next time.